but who have decided to pair up and live together. It's one new way of socializing and easing isolation. Moving in with a friend, whether or not you need it to afford your month's rent. Roomies for Life is allowing a generation, mostly millennials in dense urban areas, to craft a community, put off marriage by having companionship without commitment, and increase their social spheres. Sure, many of these Roomies for Life reside in expensive coastal cities and need to live in fifth-floor walk-ups with their friends in order to afford it. But even if they can afford the rent, living alone can get rather boring and often isolating, especially if young professionals have moved away from family and friends to a new city. In the end, many Roomies for Life don't care about the rent and believe that, in these isolating times, getting to live with someone is well worth the cost. The Roomies for Life microtrend shows that young Americans are shacking up, but not shacking up. In 1990, 5.9% of Americans aged 25 to 34 had roommates, and in 2015, that number is almost 8%. It's living single without living single, and while Roomies for Life are depending on each other to pay their rent on time, they are also often looking for more than a cohabitation arrangement. They want a friend, someone to share experiences with and go out on the town with. Another way this group is mimicking traditional romantic pairings is how well other gender roommates get along even if they are attracted to each other. Men grade female roommates higher, and vice versa. Over 70% of the men surveyed shared they would award A's or B's to their female roommates, with just below 60% giving the same grades to male roommates. Conversely, men gave below-average grades, D's or F's, to a larger percentage of their male roommates at over 15%, compared to female roommates at just under 10%. According to Rent Cafe, this group isn't getting married, but they sure are acting like it. And while those pairs would likely rate each other lower if they were dating, Roomies for Life say they are happy. Close to 60% said they didn't actually fight with their roommates. Women and men who are Roomies for Life find each other in different places. Around 35% of women in these pairings or groups turn to social media and the internet to find roommates, whereas only 12.9% of men do. Most men get their roomies from previous friendships, 29%, and women from people already living in the same apartment, 35.4%, according to Rent Cafe. Today, it's not just young people who are shacking up but not getting hitched. Think more Golden Girls than The Big Bang Theory. Older Americans, and particularly older women, are living together. This is apparent in current popular culture, too. Netflix's hit show, Grace and Frankie, has two famous actresses in their 70s, Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin, living together and getting into trouble, and founding a startup as well, after their husbands of 40-plus years run off together. AARP echoes this trend. According to the organization, older women who may be divorced or widowed are all getting together as roomies for life. As we saw in third-time winners, they're less likely to remarry these days. According to AARP, female boomers and older women, both bosom buddies and strangers, are moving in together as a way to save money and form a community. The American Community Survey shows that there are now around 2 million Americans over age 50 who are living with roommates. Often it's the roommate's arrangement and not marriage that is until death do us part. One welcome benefit of Roomies for Life is that it can be better for your health than living alone. Loneliness has been chronicled many times over as a negative indicator for health and even as a predictor of early death. This is even more relevant for older Americans and makes the case for this new style of living. According to the New York Times, researchers have found mounting evidence linking loneliness to physical illness and to functional and cognitive decline. As a predictor of early death, loneliness eclipses obesity. It's not even a physical symptom, yet it's damaging our health. So getting some roommates might make you a happier, healthier person. Case in point, a Finnish study found that one quarter of people living alone filled an antidepressant prescription during their 7-year study. Compared to just 16% of those who lived with spouses, family, or roommates. 3 people can also typically pay more than 1 person, and landlords have done the math and figured out that they can take advantage of this trend and get more for the same. They can charge more to 3 college grads who are splitting the bill than they could to a family with 2 kids who are financially strapped. A working couple today with kids might have 2 incomes of $60,000 each and massive expenses for their kids. 3 newbies who have come to the big city might have $140,000 in income together and almost no expenses. A landlord could maybe get $2,500 a month from the first and $3,500 a month from the second group. This is one reason why rents in key urban areas like New York, D.C., and San Francisco have skyrocketed, in turn forcing even people who might have lived alone to get a roomie, while also making it harder for families to live in the city. This is why folks with roommates have gone from being seen as an undesirable hassle, which landlords would often try to avoid, to being accommodated now, with easy lease terms, smaller security deposits, and better amenities. One unicorn startup company, unicorns have private valuations over $1 billion, WeWork, has expanded into commune-like living accommodations that mimic co-working spaces. Called WeLive, they aim to further blend work and life. The roomies for life trend is also influencing design. Nobody wants to take the small closet or draw straws for the room with no bathroom attached. The result is more apartments with equal-sized bedrooms, with closets and a bathroom for each. These changes increase the attractiveness of new apartments for this very attractive subgroup. Despite having more disposable income, roomies for life typically cut the cable cord and demand more internet. And only 1 in 5 are getting a landline. All this is accelerating the decline in these services and is bad news for the stock and bondholders of the landline and cable companies. Traditionally, having a roommate was meant to be a short transition phase until you moved in with your future spouse or made enough money to get your own studio. Now, having a roommate gives you a lasting taste of communal living. It's kind of the college dorm you never left. The more people enjoy this kind of living, the more it will continue to change the structure of American family life, as more people have found a fiscally responsible way to live single and enjoy life without the responsibilities of kids and spouses. Landlords and the business community have done a 180-degree flip and now welcome these living arrangements, offering them even more incentives today than they offer stable families. If, after a few years, people yearn for more, or at least more independence, in their lives, then this trend may well fade after experimentation. But so far the numbers point one way. Up, up, up. 28. Footloose and fancy free. For the past few generations, the shift from being under your parents' roof to becoming parents yourself was a quick one. Often it meant marrying your college sweetheart and having kids soon thereafter. However, as American women entered the workforce, and more Americans started college, something changed. What used to be at most 5 years from high school graduation to marriage and kids has expanded to 10 years, thus allowing a cohort of young Americans to remain footloose and fancy-free. FFF. In the U.S., the median age at first marriage has increased by 5 years since 1970. What young people in this country previously did in their early 20s, make large life decisions like getting married and having kids, has now been shifted to their late 20s and often early 30s. This microtrend is allowing the millennial generation to be much more influential across society than their numbers. Millennials are taking a decade to learn what they like and care about, date, form relationships, and become independent. Freed of having to take on big responsibilities that previously faced their parents and grandparents at their age, they can curate themselves, participate more in politics, focus on their careers, and make a cultural mark. Forget about seeing those young parents at the PTA. Parents are going to be older than ever. With the delay in parenthood also comes the delay in moving to the suburbs, and thus new life for vibrant cities like New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Washington, D.C. Suburban offices are suffering, and yet there isn't enough room for new office towers in the cities that millennials are flocking to. For years, we have talked about the me generation that came of age in the 70s and 80s. These footloose and fancy-free young adults are actually more socially conscious and tolerant than past generations, but are also being driven by a considerably higher degree of selfishness. The parents of footloose and fancy-free Americans are, on average, too young to need long-term care, and, without their own kids yet, the FFF cohort is free to concentrate on their own wants and desires. Two-thirds of the FFF population is college-educated, so they care deeply about some issues like college tuition and student debt, but they are far removed at their present life stage from understanding the potential importance of religion in their lives or in the lives of others. The footloose and fancy-free don't want commitment. They want freedom and choice. This group is constantly on the move when it comes to where they live, who they live with, and where they work. One minute they are with roomies. The next minute, they are living with their potential spouse. This explains the proliferation of rental properties for the FFF, who don't want to commit to buying a home and want to live longer than ever with roommates, throw away no pet clauses, and limit their leases to only a one-year term. This new part of your life, between the time you get out of college and get married and have kids, is 10 full years of urban apartments, food deliveries, video games, late-night internet wormholes, and parties and vacations with friends. This is an unexpected bonanza for those industries. Uber Eats and Xbox can worry less about teenagers and focus more upon these consumers who have more money to spend on themselves and are in the formative years of picking their favorite consumer brands. But a life without responsibility just might be too intoxicating for some who believe that they will be forever young. Some use this newfound period to spring ahead in their careers. Others figure out what they need to do to get by and focus on maximizing their leisure time. The footloose and fancy-free calculate that their rent is shared. They can split food or use the dollar menu. They cut the cord on cable TV. Their smartphone might be their single biggest recurring and unavoidable expenditure, although they might try switching to T-Mobile or Sprint. They definitely don't need cars, and if they are able, they can get around on bicycles in those new bike lanes that have been built for them in all the major cities. In the past, men in their 20s had enormous career responsibilities, and women had enormous responsibilities surrounding children and family. The new 20s have completely different roles and responsibilities. Men on the surface are looking for that manic pixie dream girl who will help them find themselves and be there to help them embrace life. At the same time, women are looking at the opposite kinds of role models. The single successful career woman who might skip marriage altogether to achieve great success on her own. This disconnect suggests that this whole generation may have a lot of problems sorting themselves out in the coming decade. You can see these fault lines now emerging in politics, religion, and some of the cultural divides. In general, in my experience reviewing poll data, people are less likely to get religious until they experience the miracle of childbirth and having a family. If not for Tinder, an extra 5 years of dating and video games would have been great for the church social. But given the centrality of the internet in finding relationships, religion is a big loser for now in this lifestyle transition. One-fifth of this millennial generation, far more than other generations, now consider themselves unaffiliated with any religion at all. While some of the footloose and fancy-free are just getting by, others are using this time to climb the corporate ladder. A lot of employers report millennials expressing a strong desire for work-life balance and are responding with benefits tailored to a generation that for now needs dog-walking perks instead of childcare. Yet some of the most difficult selective schools and companies report record numbers of applicants. Medical school applications are at record numbers. Professional school applications are up too, as are PhDs. In 2014, there were 54,070 PhDs awarded, 12,000 more than in 2004. Unsurprisingly, more and more of the FFF group are getting advanced degrees in science and engineering and going to medical school. When it comes to politics, the footloose and fancy-free largely support the Democrats. Young adult minorities are solidly in the Democratic column, and women in these age ranges are a huge part of the resistance. But a sizable chunk of white men, about a third, are heavily pro-Trump, despite agreeing with Democrats on several policy issues. There are, unsurprisingly, some major attitudinal differences between this generation and their parents. Largely driven by social media instead of TV news, this generation is far more tolerant across racial, gender, and sexual orientation lines. The footloose and fancy-free overwhelmingly support the Supreme Court's decision affirming the right to gay marriage. Most favor legalizing marijuana and single-payer health care. But a lot of these political views are the result of their extended campus lifestyles living in communal dorms. Traditionally, campus views change over time. Most of the Fox News generation voted for John F. Kennedy over Richard Nixon and grew more conservative as they got older. The open question is whether this generation will undergo these same changes as they get married, have children, and move to the suburbs, or whether many will like to be footloose and fancy-free forever. 29. Nerds with Money. In 1984, the film Revenge of the Nerds depicted the rivalry between a downtrodden group of computer geeks and their alpha male jock tormentors. From the crabby comic book guy on The Simpsons to the socially awkward high schoolers of Freaks and Geeks, popular culture has traditionally depicted nerds as lovable losers at best, obsessive outcasts at worst. But today's nerds have little need for revenge. Dozens of trend pieces have noted that, in the age of Silicon Valley tech startups and multi-billion dollar comic book movies, nerdy is the new cool. Skills once considered painfully uncool, like computer engineering and data science, lead to six-figure salaries in today's information economy. The median annual salary for IT managers, for instance, is over $130,000. And plenty of today's doctors, lawyers, financial analysts, and executives spent their childhoods reading Star Trek zines and playing Dungeons and Dragons. So now that a generation of nerds have grown up and acquired a healthy disposable income, have they put aside their childhood obsessions? Hardly. Nerds with money are spending their dough on merchandise, games, movies, and experiences like never before. In both mainstream and esoteric ways, nerd culture has become big business. The growth of mainstream nerd culture is reflected, for one, in the boom of sci-fi and fantasy film franchises. The Marvel Cinematic Universe has brought in over $12 billion in worldwide box office receipts, to say nothing of the billions more in merchandise and other related sales. Star Wars toy sales reportedly reached $700 million in 2015. That same year, Star Wars The Force Awakens hit theaters and soon surpassed $2 billion in ticket sales worldwide, adding to the many billions the Star Wars franchise had already earned. Sure, a lot of those tickets and toys went to children and casual fans. But the diehards, the adult nerds with money, are an incredibly important constituency for these franchises. A 2015 analysis of the Star Wars Twitter account found that its typical follower was a 46-year-old married father with a salary between $75,000 and $124,000. When Disney markets a replica of Luke Skywalker's lightsaber for $175, they are targeting that fan directly. He ain't buying that toy for his kids. Female nerds with money are similarly making themselves heard. when much of the merchandising for 2014's Guardians of the Galaxy failed to include the film's green-skinned female lead, the hashtag Where's Gamora was born. A similar campaign was mounted when Rey, the main protagonist of Star Wars The Force Awakens, was inexplicably absent from many of the toy lines. In that particular franchise, merchandisers seem to have learned their lesson. By 2017, during the popular Force Friday bonanza of Star Wars merchandising, retail chain Target used Bring Your Rey Game as its primary slogan to get fans into stores. Like film, television has taken a sharp turn toward the nerdy. While the true geeks might sneer at the broad stereotypes presented in CBS's Big Bang Theory, the sitcom has exposed millions of Americans to inside jokes about Star Trek and comic books. The Big Bang Theory has averaged over 15 million viewers for each of its past several seasons, making it TV's most-watched show after NBC Sunday Night Football. On cable, meanwhile, The Walking Dead, a zombie comic book adaptation, has repeatedly earned the top viewership numbers among the coveted 18-to-49-year-old demographic. Consequently, advertisers are willing to shell out around $500,000 for a single 30-second spot during The Walking Dead, higher than almost any other show. Over on HBO, Game of Thrones continues to break its own records for viewership, although the fantasy show has also earned the distinction of being the most pirated television show for several years running. These mega-popular forms of nerd culture, along with the $91 billion worldwide video gaming industry, speak to a trend that is perhaps more macro than micro. But to really understand the nerds with money micro trend, we have to look beyond what people are watching. The hardcore nerds with money aren't just passively consuming nerd culture. They are making a whole lifestyle of it. San Diego Comic-Con, one of the entertainment industry's most well-known events, started in 1970 with 300 attendees. In 2017, over 130,000 people attended SDCC, spending an estimated $83 million at the convention, hotels, and local businesses during the four-day event. But SDCC is hardly the only geeky convention around. Every weekend in the U.S. and across the world, nerds gather at conventions of all sizes for any number of themes. Dragon Con in Atlanta attracts 70,000 to 80,000 attendees each year, while New York Comic Con estimates its attendance at over 150,000. MCM, a company that organizes several UK-based conventions, said that nearly 500,000 people attended its events in 2016. Their flagship convention, MCM London Comic Con, more than doubled its attendance figures between 2011 and 2016. Smaller single-themed conferences can draw crowds as well. Star Trek conventions are still held in many cities, while 2017's first annual Con of Thrones, a Game of Thrones event, attracted over 1,000 attendees. BronyCon, a fan conference devoted to the animated show My Little Pony, Friendship is Magic, attracted 10,000 attendees at its peak. Even in stodgy Washington, D.C., the nerds come out in force for multiple conventions every year. KatsuCon, which focuses on anime, attracts nearly 20,000 people every year. The similarly themed Anime USA and Otakon attract around 5,000 and 27,000 respectively, while MAGFest, short for Music and Gaming Festival, attracts 17,000. DC's biggest comics and sci-fi fantasy convention, called AwesomeCon, reportedly had as many as 50,000 people in attendance in 2017. And yet, even with these large conventions already hogging the spotlight, new conventions keep springing up in the nation's capital. In 2017, hundreds of fans attended the first annual BlurredCon, Blurred being the portmanteau for Black Nerd, which organizers billed as catering to people of color, as well as women, disabled people, and LGBTQ nerds. There is seemingly no end to nerds' appetite for conventions. and they are spending big money to satisfy this appetite. While day passes to smaller conventions might go for $20 or $30, full weekend tickets to larger conventions often cost $100 to $200 or more, with even higher prices for VIP packages. And that's to say nothing of what attendees spend while at the convention itself. Nerds with money are willing to shell out hundreds in cold hard cash to take photos with celebrities or to have them autograph memorabilia. At 2017's New York Comic Con, many attendees paid $125 each to wait in line for an autograph from Peter Capaldi, star of Doctor Who. Meanwhile, a photo op with Luke Skywalker himself, Mark Hamill, was available to any fan willing to pay the $250 fee. Of course, instead of shelling out for autographs, some nerds with money like to wear their expensive obsessions on their sleeve. Cosplay, short for costume play, is perhaps the ultimate expression of fandom. Nerds buy, sew, or construct elaborate costumes so that they can embody their favorite characters. Although fan costuming is nothing new, the modern explosion of cosplay, and the word itself, originated in Japan in the 1980s and 90s. Japanese fans, known as otaku, began wearing costumes of their favorite anime, manga, and video game characters, not just to conventions, but also to cosplay cafes in Tokyo and elsewhere. It became a lifestyle, and the practice soon spread around the world. While it's impossible to know exactly how many cosplayers there are worldwide, we know it is increasing in popularity. The hashtag, #cosplay, has been used on Instagram more than 19 million times as of mid-2017. Google Trends shows that searches for cosplay rose steadily throughout the aughts and teens, hitting a peak in 2015 before leveling off. How much are cosplayers spending on their habit? It varies. Suppose you want to cosplay as Wonder Woman or Wolverine and you need a wig. You could order a cheap synthetic wig on Amazon for as little as $15 to $20. For a better quality lace front wig, you might pay $60 to $70 to one of several wig manufacturers that cater to cosplayers. But if you're a cosplayer with serious cash to spend, the sky's the limit. For instance, Brooklyn-based Hero Hair cosplay wigs for the serious adventurer, creates screen-accurate wigs from virgin human hair, which its artisans hand-attach strand by strand. At minimum, a wig from Hero Hair will cost $500, but their most intricate and customized wigs run as high as $4,500. Likewise, if you want to dress up as the Star Wars The Force Awakens villain Kylo Ren, you could pay around $50 for a costume from Party City. But for true screen accuracy, nerds with money can buy a $3,100 deluxe costume from Anavos. Of course, that package doesn't include Kylo Ren's lightsaber. But don't worry, a battle-ready cross-guard lightsaber with sound effects can be had for $500 or $600 from premium crafters like Saberforge and Ultra Sabers. With the explosive growth of conventions and cosplay, don't be surprised if these phenomena start showing up in more mainstream venues. The Sci-Fi Channel's reality competition series, Cosplay Melee, attracted a respectable 500,000 viewers. And it's only a matter of time before more TV networks premiere their own cosplay-themed programming. The highly lucrative nature of celebrities' appearances at nerd conventions will also affect which films and television shows celebrities choose in the first place. If a TV actor has the choice between lead roles in either a police procedural or a genre show, he might choose the latter even if the salary is lower. After all, if the show is a hit, or even a short-lived cult classic like Firefly, he will have decades of being able to earn tens of thousands of dollars every weekend just by showing up at a convention for a few hours of photos and autographs. While sci-fi and fantasy used to be the realm of second-rate actors and scenery-chewing wannabes, we may see more vaunted and sought-after thespians drawn in by the siren song of convention fees, all thanks to nerds with money. smart entrepreneurs will find even more ways to cater to nerds with money in the coming years. Sure, there are already thousands of online and brick-and-mortar sellers hawking nerdy merchandise. If you want a t-shirt depicting Captain America kissing Agent Carter in front of the TARDIS, there's a t-shirt seller for you. But nerds with money want more than just merch. They want experiences. We should expect to see more immersive events, such as the Game of Thrones pop-up bar that thrilled Washington, D.C. in the summer of 2017. Every day, hundreds of enthusiasts lined up for hours just to get into the kitted-out bar, which featured an iron throne and a smoke-breathing dragon, along with $14 cocktails. Likewise, a Star Wars-themed pop-up bar in Los Angeles proved so popular that the proprietors opened a permanent cantina, Scum and Villainy on Hollywood Boulevard. Internationally, the tourism industry will also cater to nerds with money. Fans of Harry Potter have flocked to various locations in Scotland, including the Edinburgh Cafe where J.K. Rowling wrote much of the first book. These days, Scotland is also playing host to Outlander fanatics. Iceland can attribute some of its tourism boom both to Game of Thrones, which is partially filmed there, and to the video game Skyrim, which used Icelandic scenery as its inspiration. New Zealand, of course, has made a permanent exhibit out of the Hobbit sets from The Lord of the Rings, and Croatia has the lucky distinction of being a filming location for both Game of Thrones and Star Wars, as any visitor to Dubrovnik will be reminded repeatedly. Tourism boards may pressure local governments to give ever-increasing tax incentives to the films and TV shows that will ever more attract nerds with money to their towns. Nerds with money are setting the tone for culture and expression. Losers and outcasts no more. These nerds are using the power of their pocketbooks to carve out the geek chic lifestyle of their dreams. It's up to the enterprising among us to boldly go where they take us, meeting their demand for a nerdier future. 30. Uptown Stoners. When you think of pot smokers, you don't necessarily think of rich elites. Stoners are the losers in their mom's basements, wasting their time and playing video games. The marijuana industry has exploded to serve many different types of Americans, and one is the upscale elite. There are now uptown stoners, people with money and power getting high and loving it. Uptown stoners may change the whole face of the developing pot industry and make it a lot sexier, glamorous, and profitable, not to mention legal. Startups are catering to this demographic. There was always money in drugs, but now there could be big, big money in legal drugs. In some states, customers can now spend huge sums on their weed and everything that goes with it without fearing the law, and they aren't hesitating to shell out their money. This means that the next drug crisis could very well be with the uptown stoners who go too far too fast. Limousine liberals and the wine and brie cliques are now being replaced by this new kind of liberal who's open to regular legalized drug use. In fact, studies show that the higher the household income, the higher the potential expenditure for the use of marijuana. Higher wages will bring on new highs. The full effects of this phenomenon have yet to play out, not just because of the law, but because a lot of the more regular marijuana users are younger and have not reached their full earning power yet. It's possible that, like generations before them, they will become prudish once they have kids and give it up, at least until they become empty nesters. But alcohol became integrated into life in the suburbs, and it's possible that same process will occur over the next two decades. There are still more downscale than upscale users of pot, so those opening their businesses will have to decide. Do you want to be Apple or Samsung? The latter, do you want to deal with a lot of customers who are stretched to their limits and spending less on average, or do you want to cater to the smaller upscale crowd that has extra money? The possibilities on the luxury end, for new kinds of restaurants, social clubs, and private clubs, are endless. There are already websites, schools, and seminars that cater to the would-be marijuana entrepreneur. in places like Colorado, which did $760 million in weed sales in 2016, you can't deny the power of pot. Many startups have hopped into the space to give uptown stoners the cachet and style that they want to associate with getting high. Bebo was one of these such companies. Bebo's leadership comes from a fashion and design background, and their products, like a fancy tin of pastille pot edibles, feel like fine jewelry or other very high-end goods, not some hash from a guy down the street. Bebo's products aren't carried in many stores, but one place they are in stock is in Aspen, the exclusive ski and resort town with some of the most expensive homes in the country and some of America's richest visitors. Marijuana marketing to the upscale is taking all of the forms that usually work with today's upper class. First, some companies are trying to depict themselves as farm-to-table, emphasizing that their products are completely organic. Others are building dispensaries and shops that have modern counters and a chic design. Then there are the products. Expect to see lots of differentiation, not just regarding chocolates, cookies, brownies, and other food items, but regarding origin and gradations in quality. You can expect restaurants that sell home meals laced with cannabis, and venues that will identify specifically as serving cannabis, while others will identify as serving alcohol. New York may regain its original name of New Amsterdam if it becomes the focus of marijuana tourism. Las Vegas will be adding legalized drug usage to its list of diversions. Tech companies will be offering just the right kind of 3D experience for those under the influence. Overall, the weed industry right now has grown to $7.2 billion, but it's really in its infancy. The alcoholic beverage industry in the U.S. is over $200 billion in size. But while the low end could become quite competitive very quickly, industry profits could be on the high end of high. It's hard to see how this would not be a $50 billion industry in just the U.S. in 10 years, with $5 billion to $10 billion in profits. However, the tax man will not be far away. Colorado is already taking in about $200 million from marijuana taxes, and the Tax Foundation says that full U.S. legalization will bring in $28 billion. Of course, a lot of that could come out of the liquor industry, unless you believe that people will be smoking and drinking to the max. Attitudes toward marijuana have changed dramatically in the last two decades. Working on the Hillary campaign in 2007, we uncovered an early Barack Obama video in which he pushed for legalization long before it was popular. We considered trumpeting it, but even by 2008, among Democrats, most already supported legalization, so we felt that raising it might give him more votes in the primary elections. America went from solidly against to slightly favoring legalization quickly, but without the kind of fervor on each side that issues like abortion and gun control have. The proponents were clever in using medical marijuana as a stalking horse for full legalization. Even so, the rise of big marijuana won't be without worries. Driving under the influence remains a big concern. With just alcohol legalized, celebrities managed to create a fair amount of havoc over the years, with even deadly outcomes at times, based on their inability to control alcohol. When they can legally and openly use marijuana, we can only imagine what dangers await. You can expect social media to be fueled by the drug exploits of Hollywood stars, something that has already begun with high-profile DUIs. The lack of a test of intoxication level is one problem that needs to be solved. Without it, it's hard to tell who should be allowed to drive and who should be kept off the road. Rich people have big wallets, and because of that, they also face big liabilities. They will need extra insurance to protect themselves and their families in case things get out of hand. And of course, demand for clinics to detox will also shoot up, especially for the uptown stoners who have jobs they need to keep. Likewise, employers will need places to send wayward employees. It was only about 100 years ago that America struggled with legalizing alcohol, and voted a rare constitutional amendment to ban it, only to have to rescind its actions amid the crime spree that decision created. The same kind of friction has existed here surrounding the criminal gangs that import and sell illegal marijuana. And there will also be new problems that legalization creates among those who can't handle the new responsibility. The risk of getting arrested for marijuana, however, has fallen sharply since 2000. According to the Washington Post, there was only one arrest for pot for every 550 purchases in 2002, and one arrest for every 1,090 purchases by 2013. Americans who might have been wary of the risk before, like this new wealthy population, might already feel less concerned about getting in trouble. Still, once it is officially legalized, everything changes. This potentially huge and highly profitable upscale stoner marketplace will open the floodgates all at once. The wealthy have always had a penchant for exotic, expensive, and dangerous drugs. Think Robert Downey Jr.'s character in Less Than Zero, bored and rich and wasting away on cocaine. In one scene, Clay, played by Andrew McCarthy, says to his rich, drugged-out, coke-addict girlfriend, "Are you happy, Blair? You don't look happy." To which she responds, "But do I look good?" Let's hope, above all, that the trend is not headed in this direction. 31. Intelligent TV. 10 years ago, if you asked someone, "Do you watch a lot of television?" they would deny even touching their TV set. Spending time on your couch flipping channels was for kids and people who didn't want to pick up a book, or that day's New York Times. The rise of TV represented the dumbing down of our culture. If you did watch your share of shows, you surely didn't admit it in public. And of course, you never, ever watched The Apprentice. Fast forward a decade, and college-educated elites are not only admitting to, but emphatically celebrating the TV they watch. Conversation shifted from, "You don't watch Survivor, do you?" to, "You watch Breaking Bad?" These TV-loving elites have new season launch parties and final episode costume fetes to celebrate their love for Homeland or Game of Thrones, complete with snacks and cocktails that celebrate certain characters or plot lines. Behind this drastic change are numbers, economics, and incentives. It didn't just happen. Satellite and cable TV, the latter of which reached almost 2 out of 3 households before people started cutting the cord, changed the viewing landscape from just a few channels to an unlimited number. At first, that spawned more news and more sports. But over time, it revolutionized the economics of entertainment content. When the funnel for content was narrow, moving through a handful of networks, a successful show had to have enormous viewership. A network hit such as Seinfeld would regularly reach 22% of all households. Television advertising was broad rather than targeted, and the jokes had to be jokes that wide swaths of the public would enjoy and find funny. TV was geared to the average intellect or below, often with plenty of slapstick. Plots were simple, and something like Masterpiece Theater was for the snobbish elites that would not be caught dead watching the vast wasteland of TV. Part of the cable TV proposition was the idea of a premium channel. HBO started out as a way to see movies earlier than you would on regular TV because you paid a premium, in the form of a monthly fee for the privilege. As movies alone became less of a unique draw, HBO and later Showtime turned to unique series as a way to attract more subscribers. The Sopranos was born. And along with it, a grittier, more complex, more intelligent approach to an hour of TV. It was unique and compelling enough to pry $12 a month out of the rich city dwellers who had access to it. And the formula has been repeated over and over again. An anti-hero star. A family that knows what's going on, but are also just regular enough, with their school plays and soccer games. The business associates who would just as soon kill everybody to make an extra buck. Throw in some swearing and a little sex, you don't get on network TV, and you're there, whether it's Narcos, even Pablo Escobar loves his mother on TV, or Breaking Bad, with its high school teacher turned drug kingpin. A decade past The Sopranos, and channels had multiplied, causing the TV audience to split up. From then on, people realized that TV, like technology, could have a long tail. It was previously not economically viable for a show to attract just a half million or a million viewers. But as channels proliferated, niche shows became a real business proposition, especially if they could bring in the core demographics advertisers craved. At international and rerun distribution, and content for small audiences started to mushroom. TV had discovered the microtrend. The number of shows exploded from about 100 in 1975 on your television set to hundreds of programs at your fingertips. This did not just create intelligent TV. It also created room on the other end of the spectrum for really crude and trashy TV. Of course, TV was often seen as the lowest common denominator, so that's not the big news here. What's more interesting and increasingly more valuable is how the upper end, or premium space, has continued to expand. Stephen Johnson's book, Everything Bad is Good for You, How Today's Popular Culture is Actually Making Us Smarter, might explain how television has become smarter from a storytelling standpoint. Part of the reason recent TV shows are so good these days is that primary narrative threads are more elaborate, each character with its own clearly defined story arc. First, there were shows like Mary Tyler Moore, then mindless shows like Three's Company. Hill Street Blues started to play with some plot multi-threading. Compare today's shows to the old Starsky and Hutch episodes, for example. Starsky and Hutch was a show with a couple of main characters and a fairly simplistic linear plotline in each episode. It started with a comedic subplot, went into some drama related to catching the week's bad guys, then ended with a comedic subplot. Compare that to a television show like Game of Thrones, where you need your own playbook and set of family trees to keep up. I have a friend with a spreadsheet of theories. But that's the point. Television has found its way and learned to challenge our best storytelling senses. And that makes for some great dinner conversations. Intelligent TV does not affect just viewers. It also affects those whose careers are now colorfully depicted, whether they are billionaire hedge fund managers or crafty lawyers. I once did a study for the New York City Police Department, concerned that police shows like Kojak were creating unrealistic impressions of the police with the public. They wondered if people now thought the police were a bunch of wild operators who wrecked cars and roughed up suspects, like the police on TV. I polled both police and members of the public. The results were stunning. The public had the same views of the police, regardless of how much cop TV they watched. The police, on the other hand, were deeply affected by the shows. The more cop dramas that police watched, the more cars they tended to wreck on the job. There's no question that in Washington, many will now measure their success and techniques against what they think Frank Underwood from House of Cards would have done in similar circumstances. In the last few years, streaming content started to make its way to the public with Amazon Video, iTunes, Hulu, and of course Netflix. Cable TV made people pay for a tasting menu with a lot of courses, whether they ate them or not. There were a few pay-per-view events and movies, but they were limited in number by technology. Netflix has adapted a similar all-you-can-eat model for the cord-cutting generation, while iTunes illustrates the pay-per-unit business model. Amazon created a mix of both, giving Prime members the older content for free and charging per piece for the new stuff. It's no question that streaming services represent a huge threat to cable. And yet, there are limits to the economic advantages of one business model versus the other. Typically, the all-you-can-eat philosophy tends to win out with American consumers, witness AT&T and Verizon eventually both having to offer unlimited plans due to competition, even though it benefits the high-volume user. Same thing with the power of Spotify versus Apple's model of paying per song. We are an all-you-can-eat nation. It turns out that much of the internet infrastructure today is built just to deliver content from Netflix, YouTube, and other video providers. 1 minute of video essentially uses all of the internet bandwidth that years of email would require. In fact, 40% of all internet traffic today is generated by Netflix alone. So-called net neutrality is, in my view, little more than a Netflix-YouTube welfare policy. But they won the war, and as a result, video is essentially privileged content, so it's multiplying. It didn't take long for these new alternative providers of entertainment to realize that providing the same movies at the same time as everyone else was not much of a differentiating proposition. Streaming services, as a result of this discovery, took the same route that HBO did a decade earlier. They've started to develop their own original content and are creating more and more shows. In the third quarter of 2017, Netflix reported having 109.25 million streaming subscribers all over the world, compared to 11.17 million in 2011. The company started launching its own content in 2012 and has reaped major rewards. In 2016, Netflix reported having an annual revenue of $8.83 billion. And Netflix and Hulu are now winning Emmys, turning the entertainment world upside down with mega hits like Stranger Things. Technology today enables us to consume TV in ways that allow for more and more differentiation of the marketplace. You no longer have to share one screen with your brother. You can watch on your own tablet or iPhone from almost anywhere. Most people are watching their own shows at whatever time of day they prefer. Currently, it's 5 hours a day total per average American, which means television producers can win big if they have even a small following. You can sit downstairs and watch Downton Abbey while your kids watch Game of Thrones in another room. If you are a writer, actor, or actress, or an aspiring one who's still stuck waiting tables, all of this is great news for you. The number of writing and acting jobs has increased along with the number of shows, opening up opportunities for people who would most likely never get a break otherwise. In fact, the cost of talent has escalated so much that companies like Disney have pioneered the idea of deliberately using no-name talent and teaching them what they need to know to save money. It has often worked, sometimes too well, as unknowns then became huge talents with huge fees attached once again. What's being produced for the small screen now rivals what's being produced for the big screen, and this is causing some added disruptions. For Hollywood, making movies that will get people out of their houses has become harder and more expensive, increasingly driven by massive special effects. At the same time, making a TV show has become simpler and cheaper. At the end of the day, it's likely that China will save Hollywood from Silicon Valley. Consumers there are just getting exposed to the wider world of big entertainment, and they are happy to get out of the house and go to the movies in record-breaking numbers. Intelligent TV is here to stay. It's got a business model and viewers from millennials through baby boomers who have more education today and want complex, adult-oriented fare. It's presenting Hollywood with new challenges. Yet at the same time, billions of new dollars are flowing into content creation, expanding the overall industry. Fueling all this excitement is the phenomenon of binge-watching, especially among the footloose and fancy-free, which can lead to the breakout of a new series literally overnight. But if you find yourself on plot overload, don't worry. You will always be able to tune into The Bachelorette Season 17. 32. Korean Beauty. If you're on Facebook these days, you might see an unusual-looking advertisement. It all started when actress Drew Barrymore put on a beauty mask that, in just 10 minutes, seemed to drop her age by 10 years. The video she recorded caused a frenzy for the product, called Hanacure. The Hanacure Cosmetics mask is just one example of a Korean beauty trend that exploded in the United States. With viral fame and fans of K-beauty at an all-time high, places like Sephora are booming through the success of the newest Korean beauty mask, lip peel, and snail cream. Their top five bestsellers? Claire's freshly juiced vitamin C serum, Sun and Parker beauty water, Misha Time Revolution First Treatment Essence Intensive Moist, Korsk's Acne Pimple Master Patch, and Misha Super Aquacell Renew Snail Cream. According to cult K-beauty site Soko Glam, snails have never been chicer. American women are hungrier for beauty products than ever. Companies are eager to give them what they want, and to do so in a more diverse and inclusive way than ever before. From celebrities like Rihanna and her makeup line Fenty Beauty, to Kylie Jenner and her company Kylie Cosmetics, to other influencers creating and endorsing lip palettes, face washes, and night creams, the typical American woman has started to purchase a lot more than cold cream and mascara. The explosion of Korean beauty in American retailers is a small example of the globalization of industries increasingly of interest to American women. It also shows the power of new cultures to influence American consumers and markets. Korean beauty success outside of Korea also shows the power of the international consumer. With global standards of beauty changing, and an ability to order products from all over the world, starting a business in one country could make you an overnight success in another. Over the past few years, South Korea has exploded as the go-to spot for beauty and skincare trends, like sheet masks that are all over Instagram, and the shelves of Sephora and Blue Mercury. The hashtag sheetmask on Instagram yields over 200,000 posts, and hashtag Korean beauty yields nearly 500,000. The sales support the frenzy, too. Exports of South Korean beauty products to Southeast Asian countries alone increased by 31.6% between 2012 and 2013, and surely that number has surged. The overall Korean cosmetics market, $7.3 billion, is projected to post an average of 10% growth each year by 2020. That's the GDP of some countries. The amount of money being spent around the globe on Korean beauty products is astounding. Total production and exports on Korean cosmetics increased by 8.2% and 61.6% respectively from 2015 to 2016. In 2013, Korea exported only $1.3 billion in cosmetics. In 2017, it was estimated that the Korean beauty market was a $13 billion enterprise. Research firm Mintel predicts that the Korean beauty market will grow steadily through 2020. One Korean company in particular, Innisfree, has become a standout in the marketplace. Vogue, capital of all things beauty and fashion, reported in August 2017 that the brand, which had started as a Korean cult favorite, was coming to the United States. This was after years of American women ordering Innisfree products on Amazon, or asking friends who lived in Asia to send back their vitamin C sheet masks. Innisfree shops are on dozens of street corners in Seoul. But in the American market, they will be open with a two-story boutique in Union Square in Manhattan. Precious and crucial prime real estate with a hefty price tag. It's a statement about the brand's already existing market in the U.S. Innisfree follows the tradition of many Korean beauty products. Simplicity, cleanliness, and a perfect complexion. And increasingly, American women are turning to simple, though product-intensive, beauty routines to achieve a desire for perfect skin, as opposed to a perfectly made-up face. Innisfree caters to that. On its website, the brand describes itself as a natural brand that shares the benefits of nature from the pristine island of Jeju for healthy beauty, and pursues an eco-friendly green life to preserve the balance of nature. It feeds directly into a desire for pure and clean ideals of beauty and wellness, as we also saw in Wellness Freaks. And it is fueling a lot of spending. Luxury brands are taking note of the desire for Korean beauty imports all over the world. Selfridges, an expensive department store in London, launched its own mini Korean beauty department within the store's cosmetics section itself. American luxury retailer Neiman Marcus has a Korean beauty section on its website with pricey items to match, like Salasu's Herblinic EX Restorative Ampoules at a whopping $200 for only 5 capsules. It's not just destination stores like Neiman Marcus where you can apply lip scrubs from Seoul. The trend is also trickling down to the everyday American shopper. Target now has its own Korean beauty sheet masks and line. And drugstore chain CVS, more than 9,600 stores nationwide, has a collaboration with the popular Korean beauty brand Peach & Lily. Even everyone's favorite bulk retailer, Costco, is carrying Korean beauty.